Beloved Book One, on one occasion, Rinzai said, "Whoever comes to me, I do not fail him. I know exactly where he comes from. If he should come in a particular way, he would be as if he had lost himself. If he should not come in a particular way, he would have bound himself without a rope. Never ever speculate haphazardly. Understanding and not understanding are both wrong. I say this straight out. Anyone in the world is free to denounce me as he will." The master further said, "Each statement must comprise the gates of the three mysteries, and the gate of each mystery must comprise the three essentials. There are temporary expedients, and there is functioning. How do all of you understand this?" The master then stepped down.
Manisha, Rinzai is right. The way you walk, the way you talk, the way you see, all your gestures indicate your inner reality. It cannot be otherwise, because whatever is sown on the circumference must be coming from the center. Rinzai is saying that I can see the person in his wholeness, whether he is enlightened or not, just by the way he walks, or the way he talks. This statement is significant in the sense that enlightenment is not an intellectual phenomenon. It is existential. It transforms your total being. So whatever you do, it does not matter what it is. Even if you don't do anything, simply sit down silently. You cannot deceive a man of enlightenment. He will be able to see through and through straight into your being. Either you are silent or speaking does not matter. Even if you are sleeping, an enlightened man sleeps in a different way than the unenlightened. It simply shows that all our actions, gestures, words, silences arise through our being. From the very center, all these waves come. The unenlightened person creates a different aura around himself. He has no presence He is almost absent. He is a somnambulist, as if walking in a sleep, stumbling in the darkness. The enlightened man simply is a man whose inner being is full of light. He does not stumble. He does not grow. He has nothing to choose. This I emphasize. The enlightened man is choiceless. He has not to choose what is good and what is bad. Whatever comes out of his spontaneity is bound to be good. It's bound to be beautiful. It's bound to be a tremendous grace. His every action or inaction is not only a blessing to himself, he has so much of it that he can bless the whole world. He has become part of the abundance of cosmic reality. He is no more a miser, a small island. He has become a vast continent. He is no more an individual. First, he dropped his personality and attained individuality. Then he drops his individuality too and attains to cosmic reality. At that point, he is everywhere and nowhere. Everything around him changes. So if you see a man, and if your vision is clear, there is no need for him to say to you that he is enlightened. There is a small incident. One of Gautam Buddha's disciples, Manjushri, became enlightened. He has been meditating for almost 20 years. And those who have already become enlightened, they immediately recognized him. Sariputra told him that, why you don't go and tell to the master? Manjushri laughed. He said, do I have to go to the master for recognition? I know that whenever he comes across me, he will see it. I don't have to say it. And that's how it happened. The next morning, when Gautam Buddha was going for a morning walk, he came by the side of the tree where Manjushri used to meditate. He stopped. he looked around and he said, Manjushri, you should have come and announced your enlightenment. Do you think you can hide fire? All around you there are flames declaring your enlightenment. All around you flowers have blossomed, which may not be visible to the ignorant, but anybody who is enlightened will recognize you whether you say it or not. Manjushri touched Gautam Buddha's feet and he said, this was the reason that I did not come to you. That if it is authentic, if I am not in a hallucination, if I am not imagining that I have become enlightened, then it is better that Gautam Buddha himself recognizes it rather than I going to him. He knows hundreds of people who have become enlightened under him. If he passes by me without recognizing, that simply means my time has not come yet, I am simply imagining. And that was not the only incident. Because under Gautam Buddha, more people became enlightened than under any man in the history. 10,000 monks continuously followed him. And all they were doing the whole day was simply meditating, just witnessing their minds. One by one, the time, the season, the right climate, the right moment, and they started exploding. And my experience is that it is a very triggering process. If one person becomes enlightened and you are sitting close by him, something may trigger in you just by his change energy can give a push to your own energy, because our enlightenment is not something of kind that has to be achieved. It is already there, it is our very nature. It is the simplest thing in the world, and that has made it the most difficult. Going within yourself just needs a small push, and that push need not be physical. It is not physical. It is more something like magnetic energy are something more like electricity, you don't see it, but it can travel from one person to another person if the other person is ready enough. He will be surprised by the explosion. Gautama Buddha allowed 10,000 people always with him for the simple reason to create an energy field. Somebody is a step ahead of you, somebody is two steps ahead of you, somebody is very close to the explosion. If he explodes, he can create a chain reaction. Those who were just behind him may catch the fire. Hence in Zen it is called transmission of the limb. Our transmission of the light. But nobody can act like an enlightened man. It is not possible. Because enlightenment has no particular form. Each enlightened being is so unique that you cannot imitate. And imitation takes you away from yourself. The more you imitate, the less is the possibility of your becoming enlightened. So one has to learn how to be with an enlightened man. It is not something to be learned. It is not something like a teaching or a discipline. It is a way of receptivity, of an opening, of an allowing the master to enter in you. We are ordinarily very afraid. We keep a distance from each other and we keep our defenses. We are afraid that somebody may offend us. Defense is necessary. Somebody may humiliate us, somebody may hurt us. So we go on creating defensive measures around our being and we always keep a little distance even from those we love. Adolf Hitler never married for the simple reason that he cannot allow anybody in his room while he is asleep. Because who knows? Everybody is a stranger. He got married just before 3 hours when the enemies were bombing on Berlin and it became absolutely certain that there is no possibility now accept defeat, it is only a question of hours In the middle of the night, he called a priest in his bunker. And got married. His friends said to him, what is the point now? Because you are preparing poison. He said, now there is no danger. I will die married. This woman has been always hankering to be married, and I was postponing. But now there is no point of any defense. He got married, and the second thing was, they took both poison and went on a spiritual honeymoon. But the fear of keeping people at a distance is always there. One has to become aware of being with a master. You have to drop your defenses, that's all. You have simply to be open and available. Keep your doors open. At the right moment, the master is going to step in. Not physically, just his spiritual energy is going to give a new dance to your being. Rinzai's statement is significant. He is saying on one occasion, Rinzai said, whoever comes to me, I do not fail him. I know exactly where he comes from. He does not mean the place from which he is coming, but the space from which he is coming. In what space he is. In what state of consciousness. If he should come in a particular way, he would be as if he had lost himself. He will come stumbling, fumbling. In his eyes you will find that he is simply lost. He does not know where he is going and why he is going. Almost that is the situation for the majority of humanity. Nobody has the sense of direction. Just groping. Rinzai is saying, I never fail anybody. I simply see straight to which place this man is coming, in which space he is, whether he is hesitant, doubtful, uncertain, looking for guidance, R is full of knowledge which is borrowed and has a great ego as if he knows. If he should not come in a particular way, he would have bound himself without a rope. You are all look. The whole world looks, everybody is free. Nobody is handcuffed, nobody is bound to a rope. But look a little closely. You are bound to too many ropes which are pulling you in certain directions and perhaps in contradictory directions. That creates split personalities, that creates fragmentary personalities. But there are ropes. You may call those ropes love. You may call those ropes ambitions, desires, jealousies, hate. It does not matter what you call. But if your mind has any content in it, that content becomes your rope. Only a contentless mind knows what freedom is. From the outside, everybody looks free. But he is talking about the ropes that are invisible. And you can understand. You can see your own ropes, your fixations with the mother, with the father, with the wife, with the husband, with the children, with your friends, with your enemies. It happened when Mahatma Gandhi was shot in 1948. Jinnah, the man who has fought Gandhi his whole life for a separation of the country into two parts, a separate country and sovereign country for Mohammedans, he was sitting in his garden reading newspaper. His secretary came running and told him that Gandhi has been shot. He is dead. The secretary could not believe. That Jinnah has tears. He did not say anything. He simply went back into his room. In fact, the same moment he died, he became sick and he never came out. Many times it was asked that why? You should be so much concerned. You were perfectly healthy. This news of Gandhi, Jinnah said, now I can see that even with enemies, there is a certain relationship. Without Gandhi, I am no more. And if Gandhi can be shot by a Hindu, I can be shot by a Mohammedan any moment. He never had guards around his home before Gandhi was shot. He refused that, even to conceive that any Mohammedan will do any damage to my life is just absurd. I have fought for them, I have given their country . But the day Gandhi died, he immediately ordered that guards should be put around his home. But nobody could understand that it will be such a shock to him. He himself could not understand that I should be rather happy that Gandhi is dead. But my eyes are full of tears. Without Gandhi, I have lost myself. Fighting with him was my whole life. Half of my life is finished. Now I have to live a crippled life. And he died just a few months afterwards. But he never became healthy again. If you look around yourself, you will find many ropes. Almost a net. And if there was one rope only, it was easy to cut it and be free. There are so many ropes. Your whole personality consists of ropes. Even though those ropes make you a prisoner, they give you nothing but misery and trouble. They don't allow you to have your dignity and your mastery. But somehow they are long time acquaintances, and to drop them, it feels you are cutting something of your own being. They have become your second nature. It happened in the French Revolution. The revolutionaries opened the doors of a great prison, thinking that they are doing something great. But that prison was meant only for people who are imprisoned for their whole life. The very dangerous criminals. So their handcuffs had no keys, because there was no need. They will never be free in life. So after putting handcuffs and chains on their feet, their keys were thrown in a well which was just in the middle of the center of the prison. The revolutionaries tried to cut their handcuffs, their chains, and they could not believe that they were very resistant. somebody has lived for 40 years, somebody for 50 years, there was even a man who has been there for 70 years, and he said, "Now." Even to come out in the light, the eyes cannot tolerate. We have been living in dark cells. And after 70 years, the world must have changed too much. Even our own people, most of them must be dead, friends and wives. Even our children won't recognize us. And it was so cozy and comfortable here. No work, the food is given, although it is rotten, but it is given at least every day. You don't have to work for it, you don't have to look for employment. And we have become so accustomed of our small dark cells that we cannot conceive now another kind of life. But revolutionaries are revolutionaries. They are stubborn people. They forced and they cut their chains and their handcuffs and forced them out of jail. But they were surprised by the evening, they were all back. It is something so important. It is far more important than the French Revolution itself. They begged that don't force us. Outside does not exist for us. The gap is too big. 70 years. And we are living very happily. And few of them said that we cannot sleep without the chains. They have become almost like teddy bears. The same is the situation almost of everyone. Your chains have become teddy bears. However dirty, smelly and Italian, greasy, but on every airport, on every railway station, you will find children dragging their teddy bears. They will not leave them because they cannot sleep without them. With them, it feels so warm. And they have been such a friend, no quarrel. We are all accustomed to many ropes. What Rinzai is saying, if he should come in a particular way, he would have bound himself without a rope. Only if he comes like a lion roaring alone, no more part of the crowd, no more dependent on the crowd, no more a Christian, no more a Hindu, no more a Buddhist. If he has thrown all the scriptures away and all the conditionings away, he will come in his full glory, a man in his total dignity. This dignity is not a comparative thing. It has nothing to do with anybody else. It is not relative. It is his own nature come to full blossoming. He has thrown all hindrances away. If you come across a man who has no ropes, no chains, no conditionings, you will immediately see the difference between yourself and the person. His freedom will be almost tangible, and you will see your slavery clearly in comparison to him. Of how many things you are a slave? Your slavery is multidimensional. But you go on living because everybody else is also living in the same way. You think perhaps this is the only way of life. This is not the only way of life. In fact, it is not a way of life at all. It is a way of missing the life. Without blossoming into your full potential, you have dragged yourself from cradle to the grave, but you have not lived. I have heard about a man who died, then he recognized that, my God, I was alive. But now it was too late. Most of the people will realize only when death strikes that I have lived without living. I have not danced. I have not blossomed, I have not known myself. And death has come. And death means all doors are being closed now. One knows nothing what is going to happen. There is no more future. You cannot plan for tomorrow. And all yesterdays are gone. Great opportunities to become awakened, great opportunities to become a Buddha, you have missed. Rinchai goes on. Never ever speculate haphazardly. Understanding and not understanding are both wrong. This is a tremendously important statement. understanding and not understanding are both wrong. Ordinarily, you will say, understanding is right and not understanding is wrong. But I will support Rinjai. He is right. It is not a question of understanding or not understanding. It is a question of realizing. For example, a blind man can understand what is light intellectually. But what is that understanding? A blind man can write a treatise on light, on colors, and can be very logically right. But what is that understanding? He has never seen colors. And this is the situation people are writing about God, describing in details as if they have seen God, quarreling with others because they have a different conception of God. For thousands of years, people are fighting about God, about heaven and hell, and nobody seems to realize the fact that these are all hypotheses. Nobody has seen God. So if somebody says, I understand about God, it is as futile as not understanding about God. The question is knowing directly, straightforwardly. The question is being one with the truth, not knowing the truth from far away, from others' experience, from scriptures. You cannot borrow truth. It is not a commodity. You have to become the truth. Even if a person says that I have seen truth, it is wrong. Because you cannot see truth. Truth is not something material. Neither you can see God. If you see, it is hallucination. That's why Buddha has said to his disciples, that if I meet you on the way, just don't hesitate, cut my head and throw me out of the way. Pass me without looking back. Because in meditation, it is always possible that the last barrier will be the master. Because that is your last love. Your great love affair. You may pass through all other small matters, psychological fixations, but what you are going to do with the last rope? It happened in Ramakrishna's life. Ramakrishna was a great devotee. And the path of devotion is full of imagination. And mind has the capacity to hypnotize itself and can see the imagination just standing before. You should pay attention to the fact that no Mohammedan or Christian ever experiences Krishna. No Hindu ever experiences Jesus. They all see what they imagine, what they believe in, what is their hypothesis. And if continuously you go on insisting on a certain hypothetical concept of God, one day you will see that hypothesis becoming a reality. Ramakrishna was a devotee of Mother Goddess of Calcutta. An enlightened man, Totapuri, just was passing by. He looked at Ramakrishna and he felt great compassion for the poor fellow. He told Ramakrishna that you think you have experienced the Mother Goddess. Ramakrishna said, see, I have talked and not one day, every day. And he was an honest man. And what he was saying was absolutely true. Totapuri laughed and he said, listen, that Mother Goddess is nothing but a pure imagination. And unless you drop that, you will never become enlightened. So sit down, I will remain here for 3-4 days, just for you. I have to help you in somehow dropping the Mother Goddess. Now that was a very difficult matter. He has loved the Mother Goddess for his whole life. Danced before her. And he was not a traditional fellow. He was very untraditional, very loving, very innocent. Twice the trustees of the temple in which he used to worship, where he was the priest, have to call him that this is strange what you are doing. First he will taste the food that is to be offered to the goddess. First he will taste and then only he will offer. Now this is absolutely wrong according to the Hindu tradition. First you should offer to the god and then you can distribute it, you can eat it. But Ramakrishna said, my mother always used to taste it first and then she will give it to me. And I don't care about anybody. I know what was the reason. The reason was whether it is worth giving. Is the taste right taste? Is the sweet not too much or too less? I cannot offer without tasting first. He used to fight with Mother Goddess. Nobody could understand what was happening. He will lock the temple for 3-4 days and will tell the Mother Goddess that remain inside the temple because you are not doing anything to your devotees. So many people come and they ask you and their prayers are not answered. And I am the priest here. It is my duty to take care. Now remain locked. After 3-4 days, I will see you again. The trustee said that you are here salaried priest, your work is to worship every day. He said that is not the question. The question is the Mother Goddess has to listen to me. When she listens, I prepare such good food for her and bring so many roses and so many flowers. When she is really listening to the prayers, I dance the whole day. But when she is not listening, becomes adamant, then I am also a man of some dignity. Totapuri said to Ramakrishna, that you sit in silence, you don't have any other ropes that I can see. Just one rope. So when you see the Mother Goddess arising in your imagination, just take the sword and cut the mother in 2 pieces. It will fall and with it will fall the last barrier. Ramakrishna said, from where I am going to get the sword? Totapuri said, from where you have got this Mother Goddess? From the same place. It is your imagination, that is also your imagination. Only imagination is needed to cut it. It took 3 days because he will go into meditation and Mother Goddess will be standing there and he will forget all about Totapuri. He will forget all about the sword. And tears will start flowing from his eyes. And Totapuri will shake him that, what are you doing? He said, what to do? Because once I see her, she is so beautiful. Don't make me force to cut her. Totapuri said, listen, I can see even from the outside, your face immediately changes when you see the mother. So I have brought a piece of glass. The moment I see that you are seeing the mother, because your tears start flowing, of your face becomes so beautiful, I will cut just on your third eye center with the glass. I have to take this because tomorrow I leave. I cannot waste my time more. This is the last chance. Either you do it or I am finished with you. And he said that when I cut on your forehead and blood starts flowing on your forehead, don't hesitate. Just take the sword and cut the mother. And Ramakrishna cut the mother. And he remained silent for 6 days. And Totapuri remained for 6 days. When he opened his eyes, he thanked Totapuri and said, if you had not come, I would have lived my whole life with the hallucination. My last barrier has fallen away. Ramakrishna becomes enlightened after he has cut the last barrier. But even the followers of Ramakrishna don't mention this incident, because this incident makes the whole effort of worshipping futile. If you have finally to cut it, why start it in the beginning? Neither understanding is needed, because understanding is intellectual. Neither not understanding, because that too is intellectual. You can be a theist, you can be an atheist, that does not matter. Both are intellectual standpoints. You have to drop them both. And you have to see without any prejudice, without any hypothesis, without any belief system, only then. Then you don't see the truth, you become the truth. And unless you become the truth, you are not enlightened. So see the difference. It is not a question of seeing God. It is not a question of seeing Buddha. It is a question of being a Buddha. There is not three, the one who sees and the one who is seen and the process of seeing. There is only one. You are it. This is the greatest understanding Gautam Buddha brought into the world. Rinzai is saying, I say this straight out. Anyone in the world is free to denounce me as he will. The master further said, each statement must comprise the gates of three mysteries, and the gate of each mystery must comprise the three essentials. There are temporary expedients and there is functioning. How do all of you understand this? The master then stepped down. What are the three mysteries? Our every experience is divided in three. The observer, the observed, and the process of observation. You can take it to different dimensions. The knower, the knowledge, and the process of knowing. Unless these three mysteries become one, when the observer is the observed also, when you are a god, then all the mysteries disappear. Then the whole existence is clearly available to you. All the doors are open, nothing is hidden. The whole splendor of existence is available, but it is available to a consciousness which has come to a peak where there is no subject and no object and nothing relating them, where the three has become one. This oneness is the Buddhahood, is your Buddha nature. In this oneness, you become part of the cosmic whole. Not just a part. It is the most strangest experience. When a dewdrop disappears in the ocean, you can say that the dewdrop has become a part of the ocean, but the reality is that the dewdrop has become the ocean. There is no question of being part. Part is still apart. There is a distance, just pure oneness. William James gave the right word for this experience, the oceanic experience. You have become the whole ocean. And he is saying that he will be denounced. Denounced by all devotees, denounced by all those people who keep a distance between you and God. It will be denounced by all those who cannot conceive that you are in your intrinsic reality nothing but a divine force, and the whole existence is a divine dance. But he says it does not matter if he is being denounced. I have to say the truth. Zen is the only way of seeing the truth without any belief. If you have a belief already, your belief will become the barrier. One has to be utterly beliefless. I am not saying that you have to be a disbeliever. That is again a belief. Believing or disbelieving, both are belief systems. Theist and atheist are both two extremes of one concept, of one hypothesis. One is saying yes, the other is saying no, but both of them are absolutely unaware of the truth. That truth cannot be denied and cannot be given an evidence or a proof. One has to live it. Only life is a proof. When somebody has reached to the point where he is truth, obviously all his actions are bound to change. All his life patterns are going to be different. Rinzai is right that he can see the moment somebody enters into his temple in what space he is. What are his ropes? Has he any direction in life? Or just going haphazardly like dead wood floating in a river? Has he any consciousness that each moment he is missing the significance and meaning of life? Or he is just sleepy? Keeping himself occupied so that the question, the ultimate question, does not arise. Ikkyu, a great Zen poet, writes, forests and meadows, rocks and grasses are my companions. the wrong ways of this crazy cloud won't be changed. Ordinary people call me a fool, but I am not bothered, since I am already labeled heretic and demon. There is no new punishment left for my afterlife. A man of truth is bound to be condemned, because our whole life lived on consolations which are lies. We are all under the opium that religions have been supplying to us. The moment a man comes out of this state of sleepiness, the whole crowd will be against him, because his behavior will change so totally from the crowd. And the crowd cannot tolerate anybody who behaves differently. The reason is a great fear that perhaps he may be right. And he looks right. His beauty is changed. His grace has changed. His words have an authority which they had never been before. His silences are deep. He is surrounded by an aura of a new energy. This makes people very much afraid. Afraid that this man may be right, then we have missed our whole life. This man somehow has to be destroyed. It is not for without any reason that Socrates is poisoned and Anagoras is poisoned and Al-Hillaz Mansur is crucified. Sarmad and Jesus, and there are hundreds of others who have been stoned to death, are burnt alive, and their only crime was that they had attained the truth. Now, it reminds me that in South America in the early part of this century, a small tribe was discovered living in deep forest, only 300 people, but all blind. And they had no idea that they are blind, because they had never seen anybody with eyes. And there was no question of seeing, because they had no eyes. A scientific researcher heard about this tribe. So he went into the forest, lived with the tribe to understand, did not offend them by saying that you are blind, pretended that he is also just like you. And he found that the reason why they were all blind was a certain fly when the child is within 6 months, if that fly stings the child, he will become blind. So there were children who had eyes, but the fly was a common fly in every house, everywhere. So it was impossible to get away for any child, and nobody can remember the past beyond the 4th year or the 3rd year at the most. Nobody can remember what happened when you were 6 months old. So the whole tribe lived, and they lived perfectly well. They managed to farm something, they managed to bring wood for winter, they managed to bring water from the wells. They became adapted to the life of a blind man, and because the whole society was blind, this young researcher found the fly, and after 6 months, if that fly bites you, you will not become blind. Only 6 months a child has to be protected. But there was no question of protection in the tribe. They had no idea what is happening. And a 6-month-old child cannot say that, protect me from the fly. He remained so long there that he fell in love with a woman. He wanted to marry her. But by and by the tribe became suspicious of the man. Although they were blind, but they started finding that this man walks in a different way, talks in a different way, knows things that we don't know. He says, now it is sunrise. He says, now the stars, the whole sky is full of stars. And those blind eyes could not see any star. Slowly, slowly they found that this man has some way which is different from us. And they forced him that you have to be honest with us. What is the difference between us and you? Because we don't see any sunrise, we don't see any sunset. And you talk about flowers and colors, and you talk about stars. Where are these? There must be some difference between us and you. He had to be honest to those poor blind people. He said, I have eyes and you don't have eyes. Although you are born with eyes, but a common fly here destroys the eyes before the child passes the 6-month limit. And I can be of much help, I can bring medical help to kill these flies, and perhaps some way to cure you also, so you can see. But they refused. They said, we are so happy as we are. We don't want any disturbance. And as far as your marriage, The condition is that we will have to destroy our eyes. Otherwise, we cannot believe a man with eyes. You can do any harm to us and we will be absolutely vulnerable. So they gave him time that you can think for 12 hours. If you want to marry the woman, we will destroy your eyes. We will find them. And if you want your eyes, then you cannot live with us and you cannot marry the woman. That night he thought many times what to do. These idiots don't want to be helped. They are perfectly happy in their blindness. And one can understand that there will be trouble if 300 blind people suddenly get eyes. And you see your wife and you say, "My God, this buffalo is my wife." And you see your own face in the mirror and you cannot believe that this is you, because you have never seen your face. Everything is going to be disturbed. That researcher escaped in the night, dropping the whole idea of helping them, dropping the idea of getting married to a woman, because his idea was he should get married and then take away the woman to the civilized part of humanity where she can be treated, and if he succeeds in treating her, then he can bring a medical team and treat all those 300 people. The same is the situation with every Buddha. He brings a new light, a new life, a new eye. But you start stoning such people. The only crime of Socrates was that he wanted to teach people how to find the truth. The only crime of Al-Hillaz Mansur was that he declared Anal Haq, "I am God myself." But he was not declaring it as part of an ego trip, because he was saying, "You are also a God, you simply don't know it, I know it." Al-Hillaz Mansur's case is particularly very special. His teacher was Junaid, and Junaid said, "Mansur, I also know I am God, but I also know the crowd will not tolerate such a declaration. You keep it within yourself, you help people to recognize that they are gods, but don't start declaring that you are God. You will not be tolerated." But Mansur was young, Junaid was old and he had seen what kind of people are all around. Mansur did not listen to him and he started declaring himself that I am God and you are God also. Just the difference is you are not aware and I am aware. He was completely butchered. It cannot be called crucifixion. Jesus' crucifixion was simple. He was cut piece by piece. Legs, feet, hands, eyes, tongue, head. Piece by piece, he was just destroyed. Why it happens? These people become a danger to our consolations. They start declaring things which we are afraid to know. We don't want to know who we are, because that may disturb everything in your life. You have a settled circumference. If you know the center, you will have to change everything on the circumference. It is risky. And you are living in your misery and in your suffering. But it has become such a familiar way of living. Everybody is living in the same way. So why take risk? But the presence of a man like Al-Hillaz Mansur provokes you that you have to change your life. It irritates people. It annoys people that somebody knows more than they know. They cannot tolerate such a person. To think in this world is the most criminal act. To know in this world is to prepare for your own crucifixion. Professor Coleman Barr has asked a question. Dear Bhagwan, I feel very grateful for your enlightenment, your wisdom, your daring experiments, your life. Thank you. Rumi said, I want burning. What is that burning? Sam said, I am fire. Do you have any word on Sam's, from Sam's? What do the burning and the fire have to do with my own enlightenment? Coleman, you have asked a very dangerous question. Because burning has nothing to do with your enlightenment. On the path of enlightenment, there is no question of burning. But because you are in love with Mevlana Jalaluddin Rumi, I also love the man. But you have to understand that Sufism still depends on a hypothetical God. It is not free from the hypothesis of God. And particularly Sufism has the concept of God as a woman. And love is their method. Love God as totally as possible. Now, you are loving an impossible hypothesis and totality is asked. You will feel the same kind of burning in a more intensive way as lovers feel. A smaller scale, lovers feel a certain burning in their heart a deep longing and desire to meet with the beloved creates that burning. And to love God is bound to create a very great fire in you. You will be on fire because you have chosen as your love object something impossible. Your object of love is hypothetical. You will have to weep and cry, and you will have to pray, and you will have to fast. And your mind has to continuously repeat and remember the beloved. The mind has the capacity to imagine anything, and also has the capacity to hypnotize itself after long imitation, long repetition, you can even see the God just the way you imagined. It is your byproduct of the mind. It will make you very happy. You will dance with joy. I have been with Sufis and I have loved those people. But they are still one step away from being a Buddha. Even though their poetry is beautiful, it has to be because it is coming out of their love. But their experience is a hallucination created by their own mind. In Sufism, mind is stretched to the point that you almost become mad for the beloved. Those days of separation from the beloved create the sensation of burning. On the path of dhyana or zen, there is no burning at all, because there is no hypothesis, no God. And it is not a question of love. A man of zen is very loving, but he has not practiced love. It has come as a byproduct of his realization. He has simply realized his own Buddhahood. There is no question of other God somewhere else in heaven. He has simply reached to his own center of life, and being there, he explodes into love, into compassion. His love comes after his enlightenment. It is not a method for enlightenment. And for Sufis, love is the method. Because love is the method, it remains part of the mind. The effort on the path of Zen is to go beyond mind, to attain no mind, to be utterly empty of all thoughts, love included. Zen is the path of emptiness. No God, no love, nothing is to be allowed. Just a pure nothingness in which you also disappear. Who is there to feel the burning? Who is there to feel the fire? So although I love Sufis, I don't want Coleman to hurt your feelings, but I would certainly say that you will have one day to change from Sufis to the Zen. Sufis are still living in imagination. They have not known the state of no mind. And because they have not known the state of no mind, however beautiful their personalities may become, they are still just close enough to enlightenment, but not enlightened. Remember, even to be close enough is not to be enlightened. And the reason is clear. Sufism is a branch offshoot of Mohammedanism. It carries almost all that is good in the Mohammedanism. But Mohammedanism is the lowest kind of religion. Mohammedanism, Judaism, Christianity, all are hypothetical. Only there have been two religions which are not hypothetical, Buddhism and Taoism. And Zen is a crossbreed. And the crossbreed is always better than both the parents. It is the meeting of Buddha and Lao Tzu. Out of this meeting is born Zen. It is not Buddhism, it is not Taoism. It has its own individuality. It carries everything beautiful that comes from Buddha and everything great that comes from Lao Tzu. It is the highest peak that man has ever reached. Hinduism is a mess. $33 million gods. What do you expect? Hinduism has remained a philosophical, controversial, hypothetical religion. It has not been able to reach to the heights of Buddha. Buddha was born a Hindu, but revolted against this mess. Searched alone, rather than believing that is one of the most important things to remember. Any religion that begins with belief is going to give you an auto-hypnotic experience. Only Taoism and Buddhism don't start with a belief. Their whole effort is that you should enter in yourself without any concept what you are going to find there. Just open, available, without any prejudice, without any philosophy and scripture. You just go in open-hearted. And when you reach to the point where mind is silent, not a single thought moving, according to Tao and Buddha, even God is a thought. When there is no thought, you reach to the highest Everest of consciousness. At that point, you know that every living being has the potentiality of being a god. Buddha is reported to have said, "The moment I became enlightened, I was surprised. The whole existence is enlightened." Just people don't understand. They are carrying their enlightenment within themselves, and they don't look at it. Buddha has reported his past life's experiences when he was not an enlightened man, but just a seeker. He heard about a man has become enlightened. So he went to see him. He has no idea of what enlightenment is. And he has not come with any prejudice for or against. But as he came close to the man, he found himself bound down and touching the feet of the man. He was surprised. He has not decided to do it. In spite of himself, he was touching his feet. That was one surprise. And as he stood up, the second surprise was even bigger. The enlightened man touched his feet and he said, "What are you doing? You are enlightened. It is perfectly right for me to touch your feet. But why you are touching my feet?" And that man laughed. He said, "Sometime before I was unenlightened, now I am enlightened. You are unenlightened now, someday you will become enlightened." So it is only a question of time. As far as I am concerned, you may not know, but your hidden treasure I can see. So everybody is a Buddha, either aware of it or unaware of it. And because no hypothesis comes on the path of Zen, what Rumi is saying, "I want burning, burning." That is the mind focused on a hypothetical beloved and the burning desire to meet him, to melt in him. But it is an objective God. It may be woman or man. It does not matter. In Bengal, in India, there is a small sect which believes that only Krishna is male and everybody is female. Because everybody is female, a great burning to meet the lover, the God, they sleep with a statue of Krishna in their bed. But these are all mind games. Except Gautam Buddha and Lao Tzu and the people who became enlightened on their lines, the whole humanity is living in hypotheses. I appreciate the poetry of Rumi. I appreciate the beauty of many Sufi mystics, but I cannot say that they are enlightened they are still groping. And their groping will stop only when they drop this hypothesis of God. The search has to be inwards, not outwards. Any search that is outwards is going to change your personality, can make it more beautiful, more loving, but it is just imagination. It happened one Sufi master who was very much loved, and his disciples used to come to me and say that when our master comes, we want you both to meet. So I said, on one condition, your master should be my guest. 3 days just, and you have not to come for 3 days. So the master came as he used to come every year for a month or two. He was a lovely man. Very fragrant, very radiant, very joyful, used to dance and sing and play on instruments. When he came to my house, I closed the door and told the disciples that now you disappear, and for 3 days leave him with me. The master said, what do you want? I said, you put your instruments away, and for 3 days don't think about your beloved God. He said, what is the purpose of this? I said, the purpose will be known after 3 days. You just for 3 days be normal. You are abnormal. He said, you are a strange fellow. I am abnormal. I said, you just drop this idea of hypothetical God. Have you seen God? He said, I see God everywhere. I said, when it started happening? He said, it took 20 years for me to see in everyone God. Finally, I started seeing. I said, that's why I am saying for 3 days, don't do anything that you have been doing. These 3 days, leave a holiday from your practice of seeing God in everyone. Just in one day it was finished. The next day he was very angry with me. He said, just let me go. You have destroyed my 30 years effort. Just one night I followed your idea, and in the morning I don't see any God anywhere. I said, a God that you have been seeing for 20 years disappears within a single night. Is it worth? Can't you see that it is a hypothesis that you have imposed? And 20 years are not needed for such programming. Such programming can be done within hours. A person can be hypnotized just for 7 days continuously and told as a post-hypnotic suggestion that you will see God everywhere, in everyone, and you will be very joyful and you will be very loving. And within 7 days, the person can be programmed just like a computer, and he will start seeing God. But this is not the way of the truth. Coleman, I would like you, it is perfectly good, enjoy Rumi's beautiful poems, enjoy beautiful Sufi stories. I have enjoyed them, but I warn you, don't get lost into them. They are just a game of the mind, a strategy of self-hypnosis. I said that you have asked a dangerous question. I don't want to hurt your feelings and your love. But I have to say the truth, even if it hurts, one day you will feel grateful to me. Sufism is nothing. You can find good poetry anywhere. And bring any Sufi to me if you want. And I will take away all his experience within 1 hour. These are abnormal people hypnotizing themselves. The real thing is to come to a point of dehypnotizing yourself, because every society has already hypnotized you. A Hindu thinks Krishna is a god and never bothers that Krishna stole 16,000 women from different people. He was married only to one woman. And 16,000 women, any beautiful woman, and his soldiers will catch hold of her. Just he had to make a sign that take her to the palace. He behaved with women like cattle, and he never thought they have children, they have their husbands, they have their old parents, are their husband's parents. And he is destroying their whole family life. And what he is going to do with 16,000 women? He is not a bull. Even a bull will be tired. 16,000. It is a record. Still, no Hindu will question the point. Rama is God to the Hindus, and nobody questions that he killed one poor, untouchable young man just because he has heard somebody reciting the Vedas. The Hindu society has maintained for 5,000 years the caste system, and the untouchable, the Sudra, the last, is not allowed to read any religious scripture, is not allowed to be educated either, is not allowed to live in the city. They have to live outside the city. They do the all dirty work of the city and they live the poorest life in the world. Their whole dignity and manhood is taken away. And this young man has not read, he simply heard some other Brahmin reciting the Rig Veda, and just out of curiosity, hiding behind the trees, he was caught hold. And when he was brought to Rama, that he has committed a great crime, Rama told his people that melt lead and pour into his both ears, because he has heard the Veda which is prohibited. The man certainly died. When you pour burning lead into the ears, you cannot expect the man to remain alive. He fell dead then and there, and no Hindu questions it. Even people like Mahatma Gandhi just go on repeating the name of Ram. He is a god. And this is the situation all over the world with every religion. I have looked in all nooks and corners, and except Zen, I don't find any religious phenomenon which is absolutely pure and which has not committed a single crime against humanity. It has only contributed more beauty and more grace and more love and more meditativeness. So it is perfectly good, Coleman. Enjoy the poetry, but don't think that these poetries are coming out of enlightenment. They have not even heard the name enlightenment. No word in Persian, in Urdu, in Arabic exists equivalent to enlightenment. God realization, realization of the Beloved. But the Beloved is separate from you. And the whole point is, even if you find a God which is separate from you, millions others must have found before. You will be in a crowd. And what you are going to do when you meet God? Say hello. How are you? There is nothing much in meeting you. You will look embarrassed and God will look embarrassed. Then now what to do with this Professor Coleman? It was very good you were doing good translations, but why you have come here? No, don't do any such thing, creating any embarrassment for God. There exists no God. What exists is godliness. And that godliness surrounds you. We are all in the same ocean. An ancient story is a young, very philosophical minded fish asks other fish that we have heard so much about the ocean. Where it is? I want to meet the ocean. Everybody shrugged their shoulders. They said, we have also heard about the ocean. But we don't know where it is. An old fish took away the boy and told him that there is no other ocean anywhere. We are in it. We are born in it. We live in it. We die in it. This is the ocean. And I say unto you, the same is true with us. We are born in godliness. We live in godliness, we die in godliness. Just one thing has to be remembered. Either you can pass through this tremendous experience of life asleep or fully awakened. Meditation is the only way to make you aware. And once you are fully aware, you will see all around is the ocean of godliness. The very life, the very consciousness is divine. It expresses in all the forms, in the roses and in the lotuses and in the birds and in the trees. Wherever life is, it is nothing but godliness. We are living in the ocean of godliness. So don't search anywhere, just look within. Because that is the closest point you can find Sufism is beautiful but is not the ultimate answer. And you should not stop at Sufism. It is a good training to begin with. End up with Zen. And it is a great surprising thing that from the peaks of Zen, you will be able to understand Sufism more than you can understand living in the Sufi circles. Some distance is needed. And Zen gives you the distance. And from that distance you can witness all the religions, what they are doing, playing games. Beautiful games. But games are games after all. You are asking, what do the burning and the fire have to do with my own enlightenment? Nothing at all. You are enlightened in this very moment. Just enter silently into your own being. Find out the center of your being. And you have found the center of the whole universe. We are separate on the periphery, but we are one at the center. I call this the Buddha experience. Unless you become a Buddha. And remember, it is the poverty of language that I have to say. Unless you become. You already are. So I have to say, unless you recognize. Unless you remember what you have forgotten. Every child in its innocence knows. And every child goes astray. Because of so much knowledge is poured into the child. By the parents, by the priests, by the teachers, that soon the child's innocence is completely covered with all kinds of bullshit. And the whole effort of meditation is how to cut through all the dust that society has poured upon you. And just to find that small Buddha nature you were born with. The day you find your Buddha nature you were born with, the circle is complete. You have again become innocent. Socrates, in his last days, said that when I was young, I thought I know much. As I became older, I started thinking I know everything. But as I became still older and my consciousness became more sharper, I suddenly realized I don't know anything. It is a beautiful story. That in Greece there is, used to be, now it is ruins, the temple of Delphi. And the oracle of the temple of Delphi has declared that Socrates is the wisest man in the whole world. The people who had known Socrates rushed to tell him that the oracle has declared you the wisest man in the world. Socrates said, the oracle for the first time is wrong. I know nothing. The people were very much in a puzzle. They went back to Delphi and told the oracle that you say he is the wisest man, and he says he knows nothing. And the oracle says, that's why he is the wisest man in the world. He has again become a child. He has come back home. Manisha has also asked a question. Beloved Bhagwan, you have been speaking on the empty heart of Zen. Last night we spent an evening listening to Rumi's expression of the Sufi heart. Could you talk of the difference between the two? The reality is, that what the Sufis call the heart, it is just part of their mind. The mind has many capacities, thinking, feeling, imagination, dreaming, self-hypnosis. These are all qualities of the mind. In fact, there is no heart as such. Everything is being done by the mind. We have lived with this traditional division that imagination and feeling and emotions and sentiments, they are of the heart. But your heart is just a pumping system. Everything that you think or imagine or feel is confined into the mind. Your mind has 700 centers and they control everything. And when Zen says empty heart, it simply means empty mind. To Zen, heart or mind are synonymous. The emphasis is on emptiness. A mind that is empty becomes the door to the divine that is all around. But first it has to be empty. Sufism is a beautiful imagination. Zen has nothing to do with imagination. Everything has to be emptied out. The name of Rumi is beautiful in the sense, not in Persian but in English. Rumi means empty. The room either can be full of furniture or it can be without furniture, simply a room. That empty room contains the whole space, the whole existence. Sardar Gurdayal Singh is waiting. Coleman has asked a very serious question. And Sardar Gurdayal Singh is thinking, what happened about his time? Betty Cheese, the wife of Chester, and Miss Goodbody, the unmarried school teacher, go on holiday together in Jamaica. They are lying around on the beach, thoroughly enjoying themselves, when Miss Goodbody says, I think I will send a postcard to my boyfriend Herbert. That's a good idea, says Betty. I will send one to Chester. So the two girls run off and buy a couple of postcards. Miss Goodbody writes on hers, Dearest Herbert, the place is beautiful, wish you were here. Betty Cheese writes, Dearest Chester, the place is here, wish you were beautiful. Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev are scowling at each other across the conference table in Geneva. They are perched on the brink of nuclear war in a dispute over who has control of the Ismail oil producing country Abu Dhabi. Look here, Reagan, says Mr. Gorbachev. Why should we destroy the whole world just because of a small piece of real estate? You are right, replies Reagan. But how can we settle this argument without a war? Simple, said Gorbachev. You and I can have a contest of courage right now, man to man. Great, says the senile president of America. What shall we do? Well, in Russia, says Gorbachev, we settle things like this. We just stand in front of each other and each one of us gets to take a good kick at the other right between the legs. Whoever can get up the quickest afterwards is the winner. Great idea, says Reagan. Let us get started. The two men stand up and Gorbachev goes first. He winds up and lets fly a mighty kick that nails Ronald right in the nuts. Reagan screams, falls over and rolls around on the ground with his eyes popping out. After about 5 minutes of this, he manages to drag himself to his feet. Okay, grasps Roni, now it is my turn. Ah, says Gorbachev, never mind, you can have Abu Dhabi. Herbert, who reaches the age of 32 and decides to take out a life insurance policy, he goes along to the rip-off insurance agency and is shown into the doctor's office for a complete physical examination. After a thorough checkup, the doctor tells Herbert to get dressed. All the tests came out fine, says Dr. Band-Aid. But if you don't mind me making a personal observation, you have absolutely the smallest prick I have ever seen. Do you have any problems with it? Well, says Herbert, I have been married for 10 years and we have 2 lovely kids and a good sex life. The only problem I have with my prick is that I have difficulty finding it in the daytime. Really, says Band-Aid, and what about at night? That is no problem, replies Herbert. Then there is 2 of us looking for it. be silent. Close your eyes. Feel your body to be completely frozen. Now look inwards with your total consciousness and with a great urgency, as if this is going to be your last moment of life. Pierce the center like a spear. It is not far away, just one step. And the moment you reach at your center, you will find a tremendous silence, a great serenity. And a joy that you have never known before. Flowers will start showering on you, because existence rejoices very much. Any evolution of consciousness when 10,000 people are at their center . It is a momentous event. This moment, you are the Buddha. You don't have to become. You have always been. Your work consists in bringing this Buddha from your hidden center to the periphery of your life, to your activities, to your relations. Slowly, slowly bring the Buddha from the center to the circumference. And you have passed through the greatest revolution possible. I know no other authentic revolution than this. Just witness carefully . Buddha is not in front of you . You are the Buddha . Be careful about it. If you see the Buddha outside, cut the head of the Buddha immediately. Your witnessing is the Buddha. Your very isness, your very life, your very being is the Buddha. To make it more clear, Nivedana. Now witness, you are not the body, you are not the mind, you are just a witness. A witness of emptiness, a witness of nothingness, and suddenly, from the very center of your being, arises a great blissfulness. A great ecstasy. At this moment, the Buddha auditorium has become a silent lake of consciousness. You have melted into each other. You are just part of the ocean . Don't ask where the ocean is. Thisness, suchness is the ocean. To be here now is the ocean. And the oceanic consciousness is the ultimate freedom. Before Nivedana calls you back, gather as much experience and the flowers and the fragrance, and persuade the Buddha to come with you. He comes. He is your intrinsic nature. Just as he can be at the center, he can be at the circumference. And that fortunate day certainly comes one day, that your whole life becomes filled up all your activities, all your gestures, become so graceful, so divine, your very silence becomes such a song, your unmoving center becomes such a dance, and one who knows his center also knows his eternity, his immortality. Buddhas don't die, neither they are born. They simply appear and disappear into the same ocean. Just like waves. Nivedana, come back. but come as Buddhas, peacefully, silently, gracefully. Sit for a few minutes to collect the space you have been in. The path you have trodden, you have to go deeper and deeper every day, and you have to bring more and more of the Buddha to the circumference of your life. It happens certainly, I say it with absolute authority, because it has happened to me. Why it cannot happen to you? It is our birthright, just you have to claim it. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, Bhagwan.